From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Tuesday marked the fourth anniversary of the war in Iraq. In that time, there has been little doubt that the internet has become fertile ground for recruiting jihadists and insurgents, but the online response from official U.S. military sources has been fairly subdued, generally declining to engage with the enemy's battlefield video. Which is why, says the multinational forces in Iraq, their new online effort will be a significant step forward. They've recently launched a YouTube channel to present carefully chosen video clips of U.S. and Iraqi soldiers succeeding in combat. The channel is only a few weeks old, but already they consider it a success. Major Armando Hernandez is the media outreach embed chief with the multinational forces in Iraq, and he joins us now. Major, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob, for having me on the show.
So you're 2 weeks into this YouTube project. What is on the channel so far, and what's the response been?
So far, we have 12 videos posted. We have numerous combat action videos, videos with coalition soldiers working with the Iraqi counterparts, accomplishing the mission. The response has been overwhelming. The number of viewers is increasing dramatically every day.
There is one video titled Battle on Haifa Street, Baghdad, Iraq. It's 3 minutes long. It's been up for a week. It's had almost 54,000 views already. Can you describe for me what's going on there?
Yes, there you have a sniper team engaging enemy targets. They have also taken some direct fire, but there they are taking the fight to the enemy.
Now, this video is fairly sophisticated. It doesn't look like it was shot from a cell phone, for example. How did you gather these episodes?
Our Armed Forces Network has videographers that embed with military units, just like normal journalists embed with our military here. We also have combat camera soldiers that go out and take footage. We're also asking anyone associated with the coalition to submit videos to us. But safety comes first. Video shooting comes second.
Is there anything that's off limits for soldiers in sending this stuff along to you in hopes that it'll be posted on the YouTube channel?
The things that we will reject is any video containing profanity, sexual content, extreme gore, operational security violations, mockery of host country or third country nationals, or any footage that depicts the coalition and Iraqi forces in poor light.
Something I noticed about the videos is that they kind of lack context. There sometimes are on-screen explanations of where you are and what the date is, but you don't find out a whole lot about how the troops wound up in the situation they're in, certainly not how the episodes that are being captured fit into the larger mission. In some ways, do these videos raise more questions than they answer?
That's an interesting point. I believe that our videos show the heroism of our American troops. They show how well trained they are. They show that the Iraqi soldiers are willing to fight, which a lot of times they do receive a lot of negative press, but there's a lot of brave Iraqis out there that are fighting side by side with us, and it's effective.
Now, there's an interesting quirk about having a YouTube channel, and that is, while the military can clearly control the videos it posts, it cannot control the videos that automatically pop up next to the sanctioned ones. What about this Pandora's box effect that, you know, in your attempt to manage the message, you're actually exposing the audience to exactly the kind of messages you least want to see?
Well, actually, we get comments from viewers with different views. You have people that do not like the U.S. involvement in Iraq, and you also have people that support the involvement. I believe that the discussion is always good, and it is interesting to see how we are actually causing discussion. But I don't see it at all as a dangerous thing. It's a manner in which the military is illustrating an unfiltered view of coalition operations here in Iraq.
Well, not an unfiltered image. I mean, it's an explicitly filtered image, but it's certainly the Pentagon side of the story and view of the war.
It is certainly our perspective. Yes, it is.
As you have seen some of the other videos from the ground in Iraq, Have you cringed at the message that some of your own troops are sending in what they choose to upload to YouTube?
Definitely. If the videos show extreme gore or if they mock our Iraqi hosts, I would be disgusted. Our aim is to be far above beyond that.
All right. Major Hernandez, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Major Armando Hernandez is Media Outreach Embed Chief for the Multinational Forces in Iraq.
The Pentagon videos don't show close-ups of anyone getting killed, but we know they are. We know the numbers, at least of American service people who have died, and we've seen many efforts to humanize those numbers. The latest, timed to coincide with the anniversary of the invasion, comes from a documentary company called The Brave New Foundation. It put out a call for one-minute video tributes by the friends and families of slain soldiers, which have been set to music and posted on YouTube. The company also has compiled the videos on its own site in what it calls the Iraq Veterans Memorial, inspired by the Vietnam Memorial as well as the AIDS quilt.
Nearly 1 year ago, I lost my fiancé, my life, my soulmate, Lance Corporal Eric Palmisano.
My name is Matt Howard. I want to talk about my friend Shane Swanberg.
I'm here to honor my brother, Army Specialist Tenado Acosta.
First Lieutenant Kenneth Michael Ballard was my only child. He was 26 years old when he was killed in Iraq.
I'd just like to talk about my friend Jose Perez. He was a guy I served with when I was in the Army.
My son, Lance Corporal Alexander Arredondo, U.S. Marines.
Eric, you're an impossible act to follow. We'll miss you forever.
So far, Brave New Foundation has received dozens of video submissions, and more continue to trickle in. The group's executive director, Jim Miller, says the videos submitted thus far have at least one thing in common.
There was such love. There was such love expressed. And the remembrances were really of happy times and of things that these people accomplished during their lifetimes.
Was there one that you just can't get out of your mind?
They really all were very special. I mean, the image of Army Sergeant Sherwood Baker's mom speaking about the last time that she saw her son.
Let's listen to that.
And then he walked back into his barracks and raised his hand as if in a salute to us. And that night, an incredible full moon rose in the sky, the biggest full moon I had ever seen. And I thought it was a sign, but I didn't know what kind of sign it was. Now, whenever I see full moons, I always think of Sherwood.
You know, it does seem as if you're asking a lot of the people in these films. Do you think that most of them are equipped to grieve in such a public fashion?
You know, that's a good question. I tended to notice that the majority of the videos that we received were from friends and family who lost their loved ones, you know, a few years ago. And I'm sure it's because the grieving process takes a long time. I mean, it's something that you don't get over.
It's tough to get a read on the politics of the people in these videos. Was that intentional on your part?
Well, we wanted this to be as nonpartisan as possible. This is really meant to be a memorial. We did not want this to be anything more than that. I mean, that was not the intention.
But I wonder, I mean, the impact of all of these individual losses taken together could constitute an anti-war message, don't you think?
You know, I think that maybe it's a raw shock where you can just put it in front of somebody and they'll have their opinion. There's been a lot of articles written about the memorial over the past week on both sides. And speaking with a lot of service members who are still there, and there are some service members who spoke about fellow soldiers whom they lost, what always strikes me is that what they think of the war itself isn't as important as the mission that they're doing and the fact that they know if they weren't doing it, somebody else would have to take their place.
It's a really unfortunate thing because this is a guy who really believed in his job as a medic. You know, he was the guy that was tasked with taking care of us. You know, he was the guy you could lean on. And when you had any sort of issues, you needed IV because you were dehydrated or you needed something because you got injured or whatever it was, You know, he believed in that, and he really worked to his fullest to make that happen for us.
You know, I think about the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., or the Everlasting Flame at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And I wonder about the aesthetics of this project, this amateur video posted on YouTube. Do you think it serves the people who are trying to communicate those emotions?
Well, I think those memorials you mentioned are indeed works of art and places that people can go to pay tribute. The unique aspect of this memorial is that you don't need to travel anywhere in order to view it. As far as the quality, I mean, I don't have a problem with the quality, but if there is a question of quality, I think that the emotion way outweighs that.
It may even be that the raw quality of the footage contributes to the message because it isn't mediated by art.
Yeah, you know, it's not slick. It's there, and it's real.
Do you think the impact, then, will be different from the kind of memorial that happens, you know, 10, 15, 20 years after the end of the war? That it can actually have an influence on the debate over the war?
Well, I don't know. I really cannot predict it. I mean, we, as a foundation, put a lot of things out there. We work on a lot of different social justice issues. And we do hope that people do something with what we're putting out there. But there is so much information out there right now that it's hard to have an idea of what's going to take and what's not. I mean, you do a lot of very good shows on a lot of very relevant topics, but how much of that sticks, it's hard to assess.
Jim, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Brooke.
Jim Miller is the executive director for Brave New Foundation, the group behind the Iraq Veterans Memorial. We'll link to the video from our website on themedia.org.
Coming up, citizen researchers rake the muck in the Justice Department scandal and an argument over genocide.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Tuesday, in front of the press and the nation, the president explained how he would clear the air clouded by the scandal over the dismissal of 8 federal prosecutors.
In the last 24 hours, the Justice Department has provided the Congress more than 3,000 pages of internal Justice Department documents, including those reflecting direct communications with White House staff.
Extraordinary, both as a window into the deliberations of the nation's top law enforcement agency and as a serious document dump. Those pages were released to the media Monday night, causing a mad scramble right up to deadline. That is, if you were a slave to a deadline. The media outlet that has kept this story on a low boil since the middle of January actually is a blog called Talking Points Memo Muckraker. Started by Josh Marshall, the site has just 3 real reporters, but also an army of readers who serve as deputized researchers. Now they're poring over the documents around the clock. TPM muckraker Paul Keel has been investigating this story and collecting readers' findings for months. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
When did you get onto this story?
I believe it was January 13th. A particular U.S. attorney in San Diego named Carol Lamb had been leading the Duke Cunningham investigation. The investigation had already netted the guilty plea of one member of Congress, Duke Cunningham, but looked set to indict the executive director of the CIA as well as a very high-profile Republican defense contractor. And so when she was resigned and it was obvious that she had been pushed out, we put that together with a story of another U.S. attorney who had been pushed out in Arkansas. A former aide of Karl Rove had been suddenly installed as the U.S. attorney there. And over the next couple of days, it became apparent that U.S. attorneys all over the country had resigned. And it only became apparent after a number of days that all of these people had been forced out by the Justice Department.
If I were at a regular news organization, you know, it's a matter of getting on the phone, cultivating sources, finding documents, and so forth. But at Talking Points Memo and TPMMuckraker.com, you have the advantage of having an audience that is itself quite active. Tell me about the crowdsourcing behind the coverage of the Attorney General scandal.
I do a lot of activities which you would characterize as traditional reporting activities, such as talking to people on the Hill, cultivating sources, etc. But in addition to that, we have thousands of readers who we can draw on, and we use that resource when it wasn't apparent how many prosecutors have been forced out. So people were sending us press accounts from all over the country. And we used it particularly in the last week when on Monday night the Justice Department turned over 3,000-plus pages of emails, 8:30 at night. If we tried to read all this stuff ourselves, we basically wouldn't post anything for 4 days. So it was a perfect opportunity for us to tell our readers, hey, there are images of the documents over here on the House Judiciary Committee's website. We've been covering this for 2 months, so we have readers who know more about this story than a lot of reporters do, I'd say. We had sort of a system for people that they could document what they'd found, and after about a couple of days, we had more than 700 comments from readers. I'd be very surprised if every reporter covering the story doesn't go to our site regularly. I have to say, I have seen stories crop up that did come first from our comments.
Now, this is not the first time you have recruited your own readers to help with investigations. Can you tell me other examples?
A very successful example from last summer, there was a bill moving through the Senate, and the bill created a searchable database of government grants and contracts. You could just go there and see pretty much where your money as a taxpayer is going. And it was being held up, and because of the rules of the Senate, one senator can hold up a bill. Another conservative blog named Porkbusters had started this effort of getting senators on record as to whether or not they were the one who had placed the hold. The idea being that if you can get 99 no's, then you have the culprit. And we thought it was a pretty good idea, so we got on board. And I believe on Monday there were 30 no's, and then by Wednesday or so, we'd gotten it down to about 95. And then ultimately, Senator Ted Stevens was revealed to have been the person behind the hold. Stevens, of course, being legendary for his pork-barreling abilities. And then we eventually found that there had been a Democratic senator, Robert Byrd, another legendary pork-barreler. It was great to be able to call them out. And, of course, they removed their hold once they were exposed and the bill went through.
One final thing. This is Thursday I'm speaking to you. And in this morning's Washington Post, there was a piece about yet another U.S. prosecutor who felt pressure to water down her prosecution of big tobacco under the direct orders of Bush political appointees. I'm curious if you think that we're going to continue to see more and more of these stories surface because of the momentum you and the mainstream media have built on the Attorney General story.
It's already happening. Yesterday, I ran a couple of stories having to do with questions about earlier public corruption investigations. And there was a watchdog organization called Democracy 21 who had serious questions about the handling of the Jack Abramoff investigation. Democrats had serious questions about the Justice Department's handling of what was called the New Hampshire phone jamming case, where you had Republicans on the state and national level conspiring to jam the phone lines of Democratic get-out-the-vote efforts in 2002. One of the points that comes out of this scandal is that once you see that the rule of law is not the rule of the Justice Department, that prosecutors are being viewed in a political light, every decision becomes suspect.
Well, Paul, I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Paul Keel is a reporter, blogger for Talking Points Memo and TPMMuckraker.com. In the 1994 Rwandan genocide, the media played a critical role in stoking the violence that caused hundreds of thousands of deaths. To prevent further conflict, the Rwandan government has placed restrictions on the nation's private media. A proposed press law would legally enforce a journalistic code of ethics and require reporters to be licensed. It would make it a crime to use language that would seem to divide the country between Hutus and Tutsis. Enrique Armijo, a media law attorney based in Washington, was part of a team that went to Rwanda to make recommendations on the new law. He said lawmakers there saw no problem with licensing journalists.
His response to me was, well, you're a lawyer, you need a license, a doctor needs a license. And our kind of stock response to that is that I need a license as a lawyer because if I mess up, someone can go to jail. Or if I'm a doctor, if I mess up, someone can die. And the official's response to that was basically, and? They all started off basically with the phrase, "The media destroyed this country." Journalists associated with the radio station RTLM broadcast license plates of cars that were carrying Tutsis and moderate Hutus so that genociders could set up roadblocks to intercept them, basically facilitating the genocide of more than 800,000 Rwandans. The newspaper Kangura published what it called the Hutu Ten Commandments, which set out principles of hate such as Hutus who interacted with Tutsis were traitors, Tutsis were generally untrustworthy, Tutsis should not be in any positions of power in the country. So these two outlets, which were supported directly or indirectly by the government, fomented ethnic hatred in the country.
So how do you go into that environment and explain that the value of free expression trumps any historical fears?
Some of what we do is to try to identify international treaties that Rwanda has signed on to that are more protective of freedom of expression than the current press law is. The Rwandan Constitution states that any treaty to which Rwanda is a party takes precedence over domestic law. So we had some kind of freedom of expression arrows in the quiver, but of course these documents were all pre-genocide. The officials in Rwanda and even the people see themselves as charged with the task of rebuilding the country. And they're also, frankly, a little bit skeptical of the international community. The domestic media in Rwanda was complicit in what happened, but I think it's fair to say that the international media community was complicit in the sense that what was about to happen and what was happening in Rwanda was not reported. So the public officials in Rwanda treat any kind of invocation of internationalism with a healthy and probably justified dose of skepticism.
You were there as part of a team to analyze the situation and to make recommendations. What finally were your recommendations, and what expectation do you have that anybody there was really listening?
We kind of like to break it down into two categories. There were aspirational recommendations and practical recommendations. In the former category, one example that I'd spoke of was the criminalization of libel. And the parliamentarian's response to that is, well, libel and defamation are in the penal code. We can't give journalists any special treatment under the press law. If you as a private citizen defame me, it's a crime. So if a journalist defames me, that should be a crime as well. On the other hand, there were some recommendations that we made in terms of freedom of expression that we hope will be accepted. And we also, whether it's licensing of a journalist, licensing of a radio station, if we couldn't remove those provisions from the law entirely, we sought to make explicit that those decisions were appealable to an independent authority to try to diffuse power in the system to the degree that we could.
So tell me about the reaction from the Rwandan parliamentarians. Did they treat you dismissively and say, you know, walk a mile in our shoes and then think about these highfalutin principles that you're bestowing upon us? Or were they actually moved by your arguments?
Well, they're very grateful and they're very gracious, but I wouldn't kid myself into thinking that I was the first Westerner to come in to try to tell Rwandans how they should run Rwanda. My hope is that some of our recommendations will make it into the final law. But I think even people in the public see this as a very delicate balance. There are thousands of extremist Hutus right on the other side of the border of the country. The government truly believes that it may only take another Kangura or another RTLM to take it back down that road.
Well, Enrique, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Enrique Armijo is a media law attorney at Covington & Burling in Washington, D.C. He took part in the evaluation of the Rwandan press laws with the British Stanhope Center and the Center for Global Communication Studies at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communications.
Last month, the International Court of Justice in The Hague cleared the Serbian state of inciting genocide against Bosnian Muslims in the mid-90s. The ruling stated that there was insufficient evidence of, quote, specific intent on the part of the perpetrators to destroy in whole or in part the Bosnian Muslims as such. The word genocide was coined in 1943 by Polish legal scholar Rafael Lemkin, partly because there was no word that could convey the scale of the Turkish massacre of more than 1 million Armenians in the First World War. In 1948, the UN defined genocide as acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. Currently, the head of the European Union is seeking to make genocide denial a crime. Brendan O'Neill edits the British online journal Spiked. He opposes most modern invocations of the word and says that banning genocide denial would squelch both historical research and legitimate dissent.
I mean, I keep thinking back to 1999 when it was widely claimed in Europe and in America that there was a genocide occurring in Kosovo. And some of us who were opposed to the bombing of Kosovo on the grounds that it was a barbaric act which would kill civilians, as indeed it did, because we said this is not a genocide, we were widely accused of being genocide deniers in the press and by politicians and so on.
Now, it seems to me that you object to the word being overused in its purely legal sense, and you also object to it being used in a colloquial way to describe any widespread brutal massacre. When do you think it ought to be used?
I would only use the word genocide to describe what the Nazis did. And I realize that's a controversial view, but I think it's important to understand that is the one instance where the evidence is insurmountable. You just cannot deny. No one can deny, unless they're a crazy anti-Semitic crank, that there was a plan to exterminate an entire group of people and that it almost was successful.
Obviously, there's been debate over whether Kosovo and now Darfur are really genocides by the classic definition. On the other hand, Rwanda, where there were many people on the record saying that they wanted to wipe out a particular ethnicity right down to every man, woman, and child, was a genocide, wouldn't you agree?
Well, Rwanda is a different case, but I think even here we need to be quite careful, because when people refer to it as a genocide, what they often mean is that it was senseless savagery. It was dark continent massacres. We decontextualize the conflict when we discuss it in those ways. For example, we overlook the role of the Western powers, not only in standing by while Rwanda occurred, which is the main criticism aimed at them, but also their role in stoking up the conflict. We know that the French backed the Rwandan parties. We know that the Americans and the British trained and supported the RPF inside Uganda for many years. And I think we have to try to get away from this kind of contemporary view of African conflicts in particular as being inexplicable and just pure savagery, which I think is a borderline racist view.
Now, an international coalition of rights groups and celebrities called Save Darfur is working to draw attention to what it calls the genocide there. Anything wrong with that?
I think the Save Darfur coalition is doing great damage, because the attempt of the Save Darfur coalition to describe Darfurian rebels as the victims of genocide has encouraged those groups to hold back from signing up to peace deals, because when every Western liberal gives their support to the Darfurian rebels, who are actually quite weak, it bolsters their standing and it makes them hold out.
The Turks were accused of committing genocide against the Armenians in 1915. Whether or not you believe that charge has become an enormous political issue right now, hasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I think this really cuts to the problem with the politicization of genocide. France last year took the bizarre step of outlawing denial of the Armenian genocide inside France. France is very sceptical about allowing Turkey into the European Union because it considers it to be a slightly strange Eastern, almost Asian state. They're also worried about Turkey joining the EU because of Turkey's closer relationship with America. And I think there is something really patronizing in the way in which the contemporary Turkish government is being chastised by various European authorities and basically is being forced to accept that the earlier Turkish government committed a genocide against the Armenians before it will be allowed to become a member of the civilized club.
Is it 1.5 million people who died in the massacre, if you want to call it that, or the genocide against the Armenians in 1915?
The usual figures put forward are 1 million or 1.5 million.
Don't you worry about being accused of diminishing that enormous suffering?
Yes, I do. I do worry about that. And it's not my intention at all to diminish the barbarism of what Turkey did to the Armenians in 1915. There is no doubt that it was one of the worst massacres in modern history. But it's not proven beyond reasonable doubt that it was a genocide, in the sense that there was a concerted attempt by the Turkish authorities to destroy every single Armenian. That in itself distinguishes it from the Nazi genocide. The aim of the Nazi genocide was to kill every single Jew on the planet and not to leave a single one left. So I don't want to diminish it, but I do think there is a legitimate debate to be had about whether it was a genocide or whether it was a hugely horrific massacre.
Some have persuasively argued that using the word genocide directs attention to a region that would otherwise be ignored. Isn't it a weapon worth having and using?
You're right. It is used as a weapon. And as an anti-imperialist, that's something that worries me greatly, the way in which genocide is now part of the Western armory in its demonization of the Third World. And if we allow Western powers to use the accusation of genocide to justify their interventions, then we're doing two things. Firstly, we are complicit in the prostitution of the word genocide to justify Western domination of the Third World. And secondly, we are encouraging interventions which historically have made conflicts worse rather than better.
Brendan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brendan O'Neill is editor of the British online magazine Spiked. His column, Pimp My Genocide, can be found at spiked-online.com. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 30 years ago this week in Argentina, the pioneering investigative journalist Rodolfo Walsh was murdered by the henchmen of the military regime ruling his country. When the leader of the junta, General Jorge Videla, seized control of Argentina, he asked the press to be honest and not obsequious in its coverage of his regime, but he didn't mean it. Now Argentina no longer suffers under a dictatorship, but the media still struggle for genuine independence. Rachel Hopkin has this report on the past, present, and future of the Argentinian press.
Horacio Verbitsky has been a journalist in Argentina since the 1960s, but after Videla took control in March of 76, everything changed.
Then for doing real journalism in Argentina, it was absolutely necessary to go underground.
Which is what Verbitsky did. He joined his friend and colleague, Rodolfo Walsh, in a clandestine news network that Walsh had quickly pulled together.
We disperse information concerning the concentration camps, the kidnapping, the torture, the killings of people that were sent to the media inside the country and now abroad.
One of the people killed was Walsh's own daughter. A few months later, he wrote an open letter to the junta.
The last thing that Rodolfo did before being killed by a platoon of the Navy was to send the first copies of the open letter.
Although they arrived with the newspapers a couple of days later, it would be many years before the open letter was freely published in Walsh's homeland. His death also went unreported.
Perdón, señor, buen día. ¿No podría dar alguna información?
No puedo ninguna información, señor Mayola.
Gracias.
In that archive recording, a journalist is asking a policeman why he is conducting a stop-and-search investigation. The policeman tells him he can give no information, and the journalist thanks him. End of questions. But even such a gentle approach could put an Argentine journalist in danger during the dictatorship years. And over 100 journalists, like Walsh, were murdered. But Verbitsky believes that the reasons for the lack of critical reporting had even deeper roots.
Since 1930 on, Argentina went through at least one dictatorship a decade. And each one was more criminal than the previous one. And a culture of fear prevailed in the whole society, and especially in the journalistic community.
The English language Buenos Aires Herald was in its centenary year when the military coup took place. With its church notices and small ads, it can have the feel of a village newspaper. But during the dictatorship, it took on a heroic and lonely role, routinely publishing details of the disappeared at great risk to the journalists involved. Andrew Graham Yule, its then news editor, was forced to go into exile in Britain. There he gained an international perspective on the media back home.
The press was the mockery of the world. It really sucked up to the military government.
By the time he returned a few years later on a visit, Argentina was losing the Falklands War. And with the military government now severely weakened, change was in the air.
June 1982 showed a series of reports which concentrated on the disappeared of the previous 6 years. Suddenly, you know, people started saying, look, there's mass burial ground in cemetery so-and-so. I saw secret burials at night in another cemetery. So all the dirt of the 6 years starts to come to the surface.
The dictatorship fell 1 year later. Argentinians devour the newspapers, which they can buy at stands on almost every street corner. Clarín and La Nación are the long-established big sellers, but in the 1980s a new paper started up, Página 12. Horacio Babitsky has written for it since it launched. He says Página 12 broke new ground in investigative reporting, taking on the government of Carlos Menem, elected in 1989. For instance, there was the story about Menem's brother-in-law and advisor taking a bribe from an American firm.
When we broke this news, the first reaction of the mainstream press was silence. Then it was next week that the rest of the Argentine press started to run pieces on corruption in the government.
Menem's government began over 100 legal proceedings against journalists. Babitsky, who was later honoured with an International Press Freedom Award, was threatened with jail under the catch-all desacato law. Loosely translated, it means disrespect. Babitsky went to the Organization of American States to challenge Menem, and the law was done away with. The current president, Néstor Kirchner, came to power in 2003. Under him, the economy has grown after a meltdown a couple of years earlier. His approval ratings are very high among the public at large, though perhaps not so high among all journalists. Miguel Vinyasky is a senior editor at Clarín. He says there's no lack of pressure from the current government.
You write an article and they call you and press you for write another thing, but it's oral, it's just a call. We have no trials to the journalist, and we have no journalist killed or disappeared as the dictatorship. It's a very different situation.
Andrew Graham Yule is now back living in Argentina and is the editor of the Buenos Aires Herald. He says the pressure now is based more on money than fear.
And this government has a really evil little habit of using government advertising to favour pro-government press. And it's a carrot-and-stick situation. I think most of the press now, in one way or another, is pro-government. And that's a favour or a support which is bought.
Bought or not, one Kirchner policy has met with widespread approval, abolishing the highly controversial amnesty previously awarded to the henchmen of the dirty war by Carlos Menem. Now, new legal proceedings are finally underway to attain justice for their victims. In one such recent trial, a key witness was disappeared, just as thousands were 30 years ago. The case was widely reported. Miguel Vinyasky told me that journalists now are not afraid when it comes to reporting on the crimes of past governments.
But would you be afraid of reporting, say, corruption in the government now?
Yes. I think that our democracy is not a really open democracy. It's at the same time a feudal system with a strong personality in power. This tradition is too strong, so we are condemned to work in this kind of situation.
Horacio Babitsky believes that the Argentine media needs to do some self-criticism if it's to come to terms with its over-compliant past.
The Argentine press needs to do some degree of self-criticism. And the Argentine press is ethically flawed because of their behavior during the leadership. And they must admit it, and they must ask for forgiveness for doing that.
As yet, there's no sign they're seeking absolution. For On the Media, this is Rachel Hopkin in Buenos Aires.
Bong Hits for Jesus.
A banner that read Bong Hits for Jesus may have kicked off one of the biggest free speech cases in a generation.
Joe Frederick unfurled a 14-foot-long banner which read, Bong Hits for Jesus.
The school maintains the bong hits on the sign refers to smoking marijuana, in clear violation of the school's anti-drug mission.
Years of just say no, dare, and eggs on a frying pan were undone in an instant in 2002 when 18-year-old Joseph Frederick unfurled that infamous banner. Then, a high school senior in Juneau, Alaska, Frederick was watching a procession of the Olympic torch along with his classmates as it passed through town on its way to the Winter Games in Salt Lake City. He knew the media would be there, he said, and he wanted to get on TV, so he dreamed up that provocative, if meaningless, slogan. Principal Deborah Morse thought that the phrase undermined the school's anti-drug message, so she tore down Frederick's banner and suspended him. A long legal battle ensued that landed both of them in the Supreme Court on Monday for oral arguments in Morse v. Frederick, or as it's more commonly known, Bong Hits for Jesus. Mike Heestand is a legal consultant to the Student Press Law Center. He says this case is one in a series over the decades to deal with the First Amendment rights of students, and that the High Court seems to keep changing its mind. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brooke.
So let's start with some of the legal precedents for this case. The first and most widely cited is 1969's Tinker versus Des Moines, where the plaintiffs were students who were suspended for wearing black armbands to protest the war in Vietnam. What did that ruling establish?
You know, that was really the first time that the court directly addressed what sort of First Amendment protection students had when they were in school. They ruled for the student. They said that she did have the right to wear the armband to school. And essentially what they said is that students have the right to engage in free expression up until the point at which their expression is either unlawful or where it creates a disruption of school activities. So it's a fairly respectful sort of appreciation for free speech on campus.
But it seemed that that recognition took a bit of a hit 20 years later in Hazelwood School District versus Kullmeyer. Tell me what the court said in that case.
Well, the Hazelwood case was the first time that the court had an opportunity to address what sort of First Amendment protection students had when they were working on a school-sponsored student newspaper. This was at Hazelwood East High School, and the paper there did some stories on teenage pregnancy and the impact that divorce had on students. And the court came up with a different standard. They said that school officials could limit student expression where they had a reasonable educational justification for doing so. Some of the examples they gave is they said school officials could censor material that was poorly written, inappropriate, or inconsistent with the shared values of a civilized social order. You know, pretty broad, pretty expansive sorts of categories for school officials.
And it also effectively created two tiers of student speech, right? Speech that originates with the student, like the one wearing the armband in Tinker, and speech that's school-sponsored, as in a school newspaper.
Exactly.
So this brings us to Bong Hits for Jesus. What concerns do you have about this case? I know the principal and the Bush administration maintain that Frederick was interfering with the school's anti-drug message.
This case, at least oral arguments on Monday, two of the justices at least seem to indicate that the disruption standard would give school officials ability to censor any message which really undermined the message that the school wanted to teach. You know, I could see the Mary Beth Tinkers of today who want to wear an armband to school to protest the Iraq war. If that kind of undermines the, you know, support our troops message or whatever particular message the school wants to teach, I could see them being able to get away with it.
Usually when students run afoul of principals with regard to speech, it involves the school newspaper. And in Washington State, where you live, there seems to be a number of perhaps overly censorious principals who've either spiked stories in the school paper or demanded prior review. In response, State Representative Dave Upthegrove has sponsored legislation which you helped craft, which largely gives students control of their newspaper.
Basically, what the Washington state law does is it tries to reestablish the balance that existed prior to the Hazelwood decision. So student editors are allowed to publish material unless it's unlawful or unless, like under Tinker, it would disrupt the school and not allow normal school activities to continue.
So the bill essentially gives responsibility for the paper to the student editor.
That's correct. It's a student paper, and student editors have the right to make the editorial decisions, even if it's something that a principal or other school official disagrees with.
Obviously, this show is biased towards free speech, but I honestly don't see why a school-sponsored newspaper can't be used solely as a teaching tool under the school's control. Kids can express themselves with unlimited reach and no restraint, prior or otherwise, in their own papers, in their blogs, in their MySpace pages. Since everyone today owns that proverbial printing press, why not let the schools own theirs?
Before everybody dismisses this law, I just encourage them to go into a well-run high school student newsroom. I mean, that is where you will see the learning that we all talk about wanting to have so much, where there is critical thinking and research and writing and all that sort of thing. And boy, I think that we would really miss out on a real educational opportunity if we simply said, if you really want to talk about something, things that are important to you, go start a blog, go put up your own website.
Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mike Heastend is the legal consultant to the Student Press Law Center. We'll link to their website at onthemedia.org. McDonald's is outraged by the Oxford English Dictionary. The OED has an entry for McJob and defines it as an unstimulating, low-paid job with few prospects. The term harkens back to when all you needed to work the counter were a hairnet and a smile.
Hi, good to see you. May I help you?
Two Big Macs and a chocolate shake.
Would you like some French fries with your order, sir?
Would that be three filet, two cheeseburgers, and four Cokes?
Here you are, sir, and come back soon. May I help you, please?
The job's fun now, isn't it? You've discovered how good you feel when you make others feel good.
The word McJob, said a company exec this week, is out of date and out of touch with reality. In fact, McDonald's is teeming with McProspects. The company reportedly plans a high-profile campaign to get McJobs out of the big book of words. Good luck with that. Language is littered with brand names that have outgrown their brands. They're called proprietary eponyms, and mostly they just mean things like Kleenex and Band-Aid or actions like Xerox and Google. But when we put out a call on our website for eponyms, you responded, thank you very much, with examples more like McJob, words with sociological implications, Oreo and Wonder Bread, Disneyfication and Walmarting, Spam and Muzak. And don't forget Barbie and Ken. Like McDonald's, Mattel isn't thrilled by what its cash cows have come to represent.
I'm a Barbie girl in the Barbie world. Life in plastic, it's fantastic. You can brush my hair, undress me everywhere.
But when you've been appropriated by the popular culture, who can you sue?
Barbie, let's go party.
In 2003, Mattel took aim at a Danish pop group called Aqua, whose submissive Barbie girl was a self-described bimbo, happy to bend in any position. Mattel said girls might be duped into thinking the song was a commercial. Mattel lost. Now, we've got a producer on staff named Mike Vuolo, but we call him Word Boy because he invents words. He invented a word for proprietary eponyms most likely to rankle their corporate parents. He calls them proprietary pejoronyms, and he anticipates with relish the day when the OED is crushed under Ronald McDonald's oversized jackboot.
Brooke, we all know that lexicographers are weak. I mean, I know a few, and, well, they're pushovers. And let's face it, language is a zero-sum game. So I thought, well, what's in it for me? If McJobs will soon be out of our dictionaries, then this was my chance to get in. And pejoronym is my offering. I left a voicemail with Merriam-Webster. I haven't heard back yet.
Writing in the University of Pennsylvania's language log, Roger Shy observed that maybe the company brought its McProblems on itself. Ronald McDonald had traveled around the country instructing children to add the Mc prefix to such words as McFries, McShakes, and McBest. The purpose of the campaign, said a McDonald's VP, was to create a Mc language, a classic case of be careful what you wish for. Look up Mc, I mean just MC, and you'll find prefix used to indicate an inexpensive, convenient, easy, but usually low-quality or commercialized version of something. Example, McBook, McDoctor. It's enough to make you understand why a company like McDonald's might want a McLawyer. Well, actually, not a McLawyer. A good one.
I am in love with the McDonald's girl. She has a smile of innocence.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Peter Garner and Chris Worth. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.